There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Hollywood Casino in Charlestown, West Virginia. April's featured entertainment includes Los Lobos on the 12th, Josh Turner on the 13th, and The Steel Woods on the 26th. Details and tickets at HollywoodCasinoCharlestown.com. Must be 21 to enter the casino floor and attend a show. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. I'm your host, Jason Fraley, picking the brains of the top filmmakers, musicians, and artists of our time. Grammy-winning Latin rock band Los Lobos performs live at the Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races in West Virginia next week on April 12th. I spoke with longtime band member Steve Berlin about the group's prolific 50-year run from La Bamba to Desperado and everything in between. Hey, Steve Berlin. Hey, thanks so much for joining us on WTOP today.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. We're doing much better because Los Lobos is coming to the area. I was going to say to town, but we're a DC station and this show is going to be in West Virginia. But you know what? It's close enough. It's a general region. People here will drive over there all the time.
I hope they do.
Yeah, it's the Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races in Charlestown, West Virginia. It's going to be Friday, April 12th. I always sort of like to start with the actual show itself, and then maybe we can go into some of the career stuff. But do you have any history in this area playing either the nation's capital or this general Maryland, West Virginia region?
Oh yeah. No, we've been coming there since the early days. I mean, we go back to the original 930 Club. It was kind of a dump. I remember there's a now infamous story of me being so upset with somebody that I don't know. Back in the early days, we didn't have our own sound people or any people. We were just, we were driving ourselves. And I was a hothead once, you can imagine.
Not anymore, right?
No, I'm a peaceful man now. But back then I was easily riled, and the stage mix was so bad I picked up a monitor and threw it at the monitor guy. I don't do that anymore.
At the 930 Club?
At the original 930 Club, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Did they ever let you back in, or did you have to wait till they moved buildings before?
Believe it or not, they did. I think the guy that I tossed the monitor at, I don't think he was well-liked. So I think it was sort of like I expressed the angst of many people.
I love it. Wait, I need to know more about this. What song were you, what Los Lobos song were you in the middle of playing when this happened?
Oh, God, I don't remember that. Are you kidding me? That stuff doesn't stay in my head, but suffice to say, yes, we have been coming to the area for a long time. We've been lucky enough to play at the White House. I mean, yeah, we've been around a little bit.
Wow. What administration did you come play under?
It was Obama's first year. It was a Latin White House tribute to Latin music. So it was us, Mark Anthony and Jennifer, what's her name? Who were fighting the whole night. It was really funny. They were at each other's throats the whole night.
I assume you mean Jennifer Lopez. What's her name?
Yeah, Jennifer Lopez. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I like how you remember Mark Anthony and Los Lobos. But
well, he's a bad dude. I mean, he's an amazing singer. So,
of course, he's a huge deal. Huge deal. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, and by the way, to be there during the Obama administration in the first year, no less. I mean, that's something that, I mean, you're going to carry to your grave decades from now. You'll look back on, I mean, that's a historic time to be there. That's amazing.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, that's the kind of the pinch me moments that, is this really happening? So that was a good day. But we've been, we've been around. We've been in the area. We love it. The whole Washington, Maryland, West Virginia, that part of the world has always been very, very kind to us.
Absolutely. And we'll throw Virginia in there too. Have you ever done like the
Birchmere
or anything like that?
Yeah, Birchmere. Yeah, absolutely. Wolf Trap. I mean, we love coming back there.
Oh, absolutely. Well, how about this particular show? I mean, I assume we'll hear the, you know, the hits. Is there anything new? Or yeah, like I don't want to give away the whole set list, but yeah, I don't know, give me a teaser so I have a soundbite to play about this actual show. Yeah, what's the
Well,
vibe?
let's see. We're not going to bring any of the acoustic instruments just because it's too hard to travel with them and expensive, and they're very fragile. So it'll probably be a rock show. But we'll
Right.
touch on everything. We try to cover the entire career. So obviously we'll play La Bamba, but we'll try and I mean, we really don't come with a set list. We try to make it in the moment, and then sometimes we'll start and then we'll throw it away and just go with whatever feels right, to the people that are there. So some nights it's a dance party, some nights it's a listening party, and some nights it's something in between. So, but we will, like I said, we will touch on every era, I hope.
I absolutely. Well, let's go through. We'll touch on every era. We don't have time to do all of it, but let's give folks a little bit of a backstory. I call it your superhero origin story of the band. So, when were you actually formed? I guess it was what, 73 in Los Angeles. So, how did the band actually come together? I know you joined what about like 7 years in or something, but I'm sure you've heard the origin story from the other guys telling it. So, yeah, how'd it come together in LA?
Well, they were all high school buddies, and they were all in different bands. And then it was a Thanksgiving party. They were asked by somebody to come and play some acoustic folkloric songs. So they learned, I don't know, like 15 minutes of that, and played it at the party. And it was kind of a big hit. And they were like, "Oh, this stuff's kind of cool. We should maybe keep doing this." So while they were all in other different, rock bands of the early 70s, they were sort of diving into learning this music. And when I say this music, I mean like the folkloric stuff. And then for like the first 7 or 8 years of the band's existence, it was literally just folkloric music. So just acoustic Latin instruments. So guitars, requintos, jaranas. These are all like the little, I mean, you wouldn't know them by name if you're not, you don't understand, if you don't study the music, but they're like the small guitars. They look like, some of them look like small ukuleles. Sometimes they look like bigger ukuleles, but that's what the guys were playing for many years. And then right about the dawn of when punk rock first started happening in LA, there was a scene not going on not far from them that the guys were sort of intrigued by. So they were playing this music, but at night they would go and check out the bands that were playing, including the band that I was in at the time called the Blasters.
Blaster.
So around I guess it'd be 79, they gave a cassette tape to one of the guys, the two brothers that were the leaders of the Blasters, and they flipped out, and they offered Los Lobos an opening slot at the we were playing the Blasters were playing 4 nights at the Whiskey a Go-Go, which was like the high watermark for the Blasters by far. And one of the 4 nights, Los Lobos was asked to open, and they basically just blew the place away. So they in a couple of years before they started like playing around with rock and roll and bringing electric instruments back into the thing. They had a standing gig at a restaurant. I think it was 3 nights a week, and like, inch by inch, they started becoming more electrified and more like a rock band. And then they got fired from the restaurant for being too loud. But they're like, "Hey, maybe we could mix all this stuff up and play everything." And that's more or less where I show up. So at that night, the night they opened for us, the Lobos opened up for the Blasters, was sort of like an epiphany. Like no one had ever heard them before, and certainly no one had ever heard them play rock and roll before. And it was like overnight, everybody, that's all anybody was talking about was Los Lobos. Did you see him? Did you hear him? They were amazing, like this whole thing. So it kind of like literally blew up. This band that had been together for 7 or 8 years at that point was a quite literally an overnight success. And then everybody wanted to play with Los Lobos. Everybody wanted Los Lobos to open. And we just became friends. We just hung out together. They asked me if I wanted to learn some of the songs, and started from learning two songs to three songs to five to seven. And then I was kind of up on stage for with them for all their shows while I was still a member of the Blasters. And then there was one day when the Blasters van was going north and the Lobos van was going south, and I went south, and here I am 42 years later.
I love it. Yeah, one of those classic 7 year overnight success stories.
Yeah,
Well,
exactly.
I'm glad you
Literally.
jumped. I'm sure you're glad you jumped on board as well at that
I am.
time.
I am very much
So
so.
yeah, it was a huge act there in the early 80s. And I want to tell everybody before before the big La Bamba movie soundtrack, Grammy nominated breakthrough, all that stuff. I think I think Los Lobos y'all even won before all that for best Mexican American performance ever. Am I saying it right? In Selma?
It was in 83. Yeah, so we won our first Grammy on our first record. And then we've sort of been riding that wave ever since, more or less. I mean, we've been incredibly lucky, and we've managed to basically do this for longer than anybody would have ever thought from the early days. That's for sure.
I have to ask. I mean, I'm sure you get it a million times, but I do have to ask about the La Bamba movie soundtrack, all that stuff. Yeah, how did the Richie Valens version is so catchy, and of course, you know, died way too young. What was it, like 17 or something crazy? But yeah, talk about putting together that for the movie, yeah, and you know, the great performance and all that. But yeah, just that the key to covering such an iconic song.
Well, it started with us. So in the early days, when we literally just started touring, so this would be 83-ish, around that era, we used to go to Santa Cruz, California from LA, which is not far. It's about 6-hour drive. And Richie's family all lived in a town called Watsonville, which is right outside of Santa Cruz. So whenever we would go up there, they would feed us. Sometimes we would sleep on their floor. I mean, it was sort of like very much a family affair. They remain are, you know, very, very, very close friends for all these years. And then one time we were up there and they said, hey, you know, we're selling the rights to Richie's story. And we've stipulated that the only people that can do the music, that can do his music, is you guys. And we were like, wow, that's, you know, that's what an honor.
But
nobody else could do the music but us. And we, you know, honestly, at that moment, it was like, oh, that's cool. Like, we didn't think, you know, I mean, yes, obviously he was an icon, but it wasn't like, oh boy, you know, this is going to be a number one movie all over the world. I mean, it was really very, very, very innocent and small, and we didn't really think much of it. And to be perfectly honest, while we were making the soundtrack, it really wasn't a big deal. Like, nothing about it said this is going to be a huge hit. It was first time director. Most of the actors in the movie had never done anything before, not even, you know, like a student movie. I mean, there was
no one knew Lou Diamond Phillips at that point. Stand and Deliver was the year after La Bamba. So yeah,
no, Lou was doing, he was at a doing dinner theater in San Antonio. So it was like literally nothing about it said big hit movie. And even as we were working on it, it was, I mean, to be perfectly honest, the movie was kind of a mess until the very end. It was a little bit scattered. There was like a dream sequence. It was like 20, I mean, probably it was 5 minutes, but it felt like it was 20 minutes long that just kind of ruined every bit of momentum. And then lo and behold, as it was getting closer to being done, it sort of like took the shape that was the one that became a hit, and they cut out all the excess stuff and made it a very, the movie that we all know and love. So we were probably the most surprised people in the world when it became a hit, because at no time while we were doing it did it seem, I mean, I thought it was, I mean, there was no like, you know, cable TV wasn't even much of a thing back then, but I thought, well, this is going to go right to the bargain bin. There's no way this thing is going to be a big hit movie. And lo and behold, it was. So
you saw those early cuts then before the final version came out.
I was the one, like, I produced the soundtrack, so I was the one that was most involved in the actual day-to-day. Like, I was the one that was doing like all the, like, the script kept changing. Like, every day there'd be like a new thing, and so it wasn't unusual for us, for the director to say, okay, we're gonna do Donna, and it's gonna be him in a phone booth. Oh no, we're gonna do Donna, it's gonna be him at the Brooklyn Paramount. Oh no, we're gonna do him, it's gonna be him in rehearsal. Oh no, it's gonna be, so like literally every day there'd be like a new version of almost every song. And as I said, it was kind of all over the place. And you know, they didn't even cast Lou until very, very late. They had shot the entire movie, that every scene that Lou wasn't in was done, because they couldn't find the Lou. They couldn't find the guy to be Richie. So it was like very late. Lou shows up and he's, you know, obviously he's very, you know, young and charming, and he's kind of the perfect guy for the deal. But they were literally, I remember the director like, don't you guys know any singing Hispanic kids? Don't you know anybody that could do this job? Like, no, we didn't. And I just remembered, like, we were about to go on a long European tour right before it came out. and I was at the editing room, and that was like I that was the version of the movie, more or less. There's pretty much 95% of the movie that came out, and I just remember thinking to myself, "Huh, they really this is actually a pretty good movie. It's a shame nobody's ever going to see it." Little
And
did I know,
little did
yeah.
you know it would take off. Well,
Celery shock.
that's so cool, so cool. Well, and I want to remind everybody, A, it's rare for a movie soundtrack to be nominated for Record of the Year, the Grammys. Like, that doesn't happen very often, but it was, as well as the La Bamba single was up for like pop duo performance or something. But then what I want to remind everybody is you also, Los Lobos, the band, had another album nominated like up against that same year, the light by the Light of the Moon. So I just wanted to I want to give you a chance to plug that one because everyone remembers La Bamba, but let's not forget that one, baby.
Well, yeah, we were working on both of them. I mean, at the time we were at the studio called Sunset Sound in LA, and I was working on La Bamba in Studio One, and they were working on By the Light of the Moon in Studio Two. So both we'd all be running up, back and forth between the two studios, trying to get both projects done at the same time.
Wow, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was kind
All
of nutty.
right. Well, tell me about let's see. Let's see. I guess you sadly didn't win any that year, but you did win a couple years later for La Pistola y
Yeah.
El Corazon. Tell me about putting together that song.
Well, that was La Bamba happens and it's a big hit, and so we're faced with how do we follow up this giant hit, and obviously the movie was the movie, and we kind of did almost every song that Ritchie wrote. So the Empire Returns or the whatever the Star Wars cosmology wasn't going to work in this case, because
The
basically
Empire
the
Strikes Back.
Yeah, there was no prequel, there's no sequel. So we had to come up with, all right, how do we follow up this giant international hit? And it was
La
Louis
Bamba 2.
La Bamba too. So it was, I believe it was Louis, one of our guitar players slash drummer, who said, well, no one will ever pay as much attention to what we do now as whatever we do now. So why don't we do, let's go back to the roots, let's do a record of the stuff that we did back in the early days, and just sort of like, let's clear the palette, if you will, like, because obviously we couldn't really follow up La Bamba with anything that would be close to it, and we wanted to more or less establish our credibility again, because I think it wasn't really a big deal, but certainly the perception of us as a quote unquote party band or something, we didn't want to be a one-hit wonder attached to a movie, and sort of go down with that ship. So the notion for La Pistola was to more or less reclaim our identity, and then free us for at least for a couple of years from having to follow up international number one. So that was more or less the idea of Pistola. We did it in about a week. It was super fun to do, and lo and behold, we win a Grammy. And so then we toured with that. We toured that for about a year and a half of just playing the folkloric stuff again, which was awesome and fun. And then then it was time to make another rock and roll record, but at least we had the appropriate amount of distance and understanding of, like, okay, now we could basically start again.
Right. Awesome. Well, that's great. I'm glad you kept it going. And like you said, you weren't just tied to the movie and that's all you were known for. You kept it going, baby.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have time to go through all of them, I guess, but let me try to jump around. How about Kiko? I mean, that was a pretty big one too.
That was a big one. So that one was, all right, so I'll make this the shortest version of the story. So we had had our ups and downs. So we have this big record, and then we do this folkloric record, and then we do another rock record. But the making of that record, so the next record after that was The Neighborhood. And we had sort of gotten a taste of a lot of stuff. We've gotten a taste to be like what it's like to be like a big touring band. We got a little bit of international acclaim, and we got I have to say, like, a little bit too big for our britches. We were touring on a scale that we couldn't really afford. We had like two buses, and we had lights and probably a lot more crew than we possibly ever needed. And for the first time in our career, literally from the very beginning, we actually came home from a long tour and realized we had lost money, which is not good. So we were kind of pissed off, to be honest about it. We were a little bit like we had felt like we had fallen for we gotten like suckered by the music industry. Like, we had fallen for stuff that, had we sort of like thought about it a little bit, we probably wouldn't have done it.
Right.
So we thought we were about to be dropped by our label, believe it or not. We thought we were in a precarious place. So that, we thought, well, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down. We're going to die with our boots on. So we made this record, Kiko, which was basically us telling the everybody, like all the people that had poorly advised us and all of the knuckleheads that had sort of like, given us fair weather advice to basically get lost, or stronger expression of that term.
Right.
And we just did what we wanted. And that's more or less what Kiko was. It was just exactly what we wanted, the way we wanted to do it. We didn't think it, we weren't sure if it was great or terrible or awful. Like, we just wanted to sort of say what we wanted to say the way we wanted to say it. And, lo and behold, it becomes, another big thing and probably, one of our most popular records. And I don't know, I guess the lesson there is to listen to your heart, because that was definitely us ignoring everybody's advice outside of, us and Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, our co-producers. But we literally froze out every single other entity, every other person that had we had talked to up to that point, everybody that was involved from La Bamba. We just stopped listening to anybody and everybody and just did what we wanted.
Awesome. And I like to think that maybe a bunch of a new generation stumbled upon it this past year when they were trying to Google Killers of the Flower Moon. It came up Kiko and the Lavender Moon.
Yeah,
I
that'd
love
be cool. I hope so.
I'm Bradley Trainer,
and I'm Don McClain. We have a podcast called Blinded by the Item.
A blind item is gossip about a celebrity with their name left out. It's a guessing game, and you can play along. The item might be like, this A-list star carries a Birkin bag worth more than the average person's house to the gym to work out.
Pretty sure that's J-Lo.
And P.S. the person behind all of this is Kris Jenner,
LLC. We drop a new episode every weekday, so the fun never ends.
Blinded by the Item. Listen wherever you get podcasts and watch us on the Blinded by the Item YouTube channel.
Hey, speaking of movies, there's an unintended segue there. But yeah, you mean you mentioned La Bamba, but you also did the Grammy winning Mariachi Suite, like an instrumental thing, off of the Desperado movie, the Antonio Banderas movie, directed by Robert Rodriguez. Yeah, just memories of putting that together. I mean, talk about a completely different movie than a music biopic.
So Robert came into our world just like so. He had done his first movie, which I think he spent like $4,000 on, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was like, he had gotten it was
was
a
it El
surprise.
Mariachi or something like that?
I think it might have been yeah, it was El Mariachi. So he had just, he had finished that. That had come out. It was a big deal. So, we were friends. We had friends in common, so we got together with him, and he was, telling us about his next movie. And I think it's important to remember that at that point, no one had ever heard of Antonio Banderas or Salma Hayek. They were complete unknowns.
Brand new.
So he had relocated
Well,
to
hang on a sec. Antonio Banderas had just done Philadelphia, right? At 93.
not when we were
When they're
working on.
filming it. Okay, I got you.
When we were filming it, nobody knew anything about who this guy was. It was a when we started, it was a very low budget movie. And it was him doing everything again. That's kind of his thing. It's like he shoots and edits. Like he moved into a house in Hollywood and was like a little factory. But it was all literally just him doing everything. So in like most movies, we've done a few soundtracks now. Like, so when you do a movie, more or less, you'll sit there with the director, and they'll be in the aggregate, like if it's a 90-minute movie, there'll probably be like maybe 40 minutes of music if you add it all up. So you break it down into scenes and then sub scenes. So pretty much when you start it, okay, we're going to need music for this bit, this bit, this bit. And you sort of have a list of it that's very clear and concise. So you know exactly what you're doing and what it's supposed to sound like. With Robert, and we've done this with him now a couple of times, he wants twice as much music as there is length of movie. So in other words, for a 90-minute movie, he wants like 3 hours of music because he literally listens, like he's his own cameraman. He wants to listen to the music as he's shooting the scene. He's actually shooting the scene to the soundtrack, not at the end of it like every other movie we've ever done.
Right.
So it was an amazing amount of work, but it was also really fun because he's so cool, and we were just sort of like, he's also a musician, so he was able to tell us more or less exactly what he wanted. Sometimes he would even play what he wanted on the soundtrack. So it was really different. And once again, we start in a place and it's sort of a small budget, and it's just him and them as they're doing what are they they're sort of showing bits and pieces of the movie, and it's getting this enormous, the response is great. And obviously Antonio Banderas is going to be a superstar. He's getting more and more and more and more money to make the movie. Because when it started, it was like very, very low budget. And I just remember there was the if people remember the movie, there's that long, like the first long shootout scene where he walks into the bar and he's got the guitar case and he opens the guitar case and then he shoots the place up. And that goes on for like 5 minutes. I mean, that is like one of the longest shootout sequences in history. And we were tasked initially with doing that scene, which is, that is a lot of music. And there's lots of cuts. There's lots of like close-ups. There's the thing where he shoots the chandelier and, you know, it goes on and on and on. So we had spent like 2 weeks on that one scene, literally just 2 weeks, just literally like every day trying to get something to work for all that stuff. And whenever you also, the other thing I should mention, when you do a soundtrack, they have what's it's called a temp score. So in other words,
right,
there'll be something that you know that the director is saying, well, I want it to feel or sound like this.
Sure.
So he used Link Wray's Apache, which is a song that down it, you know, it's this, you know, we've all heard it a million times. But at that moment, he couldn't afford it. So we spent 2 weeks trying to score the scene. And then finally, I'm going up to his house. I'm saying, all right, Robert, we finally got the fight scene. We got something to show you. He goes, oh, don't worry about it. I bought Link Wray's song. So we spent 2 weeks trying to get this thing right. And they had given him whatever it was, $100,000 to buy Link Wray's song for the scene. So that's what's actually in the movie is the Link Wray song. But yeah, that's
right after Link Wray, the other one, was it Rumble? Was in
Rumble,
Fiction,
yeah.
Pulp Fiction, right, for Tarantino. And yeah, he teamed up with Robert Rodriguez on what was Still Dawn race after that. So it all ties together in my crazy brain. But did Robert because he did the music for Sin City years later. Like he actually did some of the music, but did he ask you for advice on this whole temp process?
I was just sort of like, you know, we were amazed that, you know, as was he, like he was very surprised that they were like, hey, you need more money? Like here, well, you know what, you want that? Oh, you want Link Wray? Oh, here, take it. So it was certainly no surprise to us that he was on his way up to the stratosphere. You know, he's obviously a great guy, and he remains, you know, a good friend. We see him when we go to Austin still.
That's cool. Well, bravo on the Mariachi Suite winning for that, which is what got us started on that. And you were up against your own children's album too, Papa's Dream, for around that same time. So.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
That's quite a, I needed to point that out because that's quite the juxtaposition, you know, guns and guitar cases and then a children's album. Bully bully.
That's our world.
That's awesome. We've been generous with your time. Do we have time to hit any more? Tin Can Trust? Trust, Americana, best Americana album nominated. Memories of putting that together real fast.
Some records I remember are challenging. You know, sometimes you enter them with the best intentions and they present a series of problems that need to be solved, or, you know, people that are sort of on different wavelengths, and you know, you just sort of need to coax whatever you can from the whatever you have at the moment. But that one was what made that one easy and pleasant was we had always recorded in Hollywood, and the studios in Hollywood are pretty great, but it was always sort of a drag for the guys because they were still living in East LA at the time, and you know, traffic was kind of a pain in the neck, and it was always sort of a house, like every session would start like 2 or 3 hours late because somebody got stuck somewhere. It was always sort of like a ongoing bone of contention that we always had to drive to Hollywood to make records. So for Tin Can Trust, we found this really cool studio in East LA that was more or less in the guy's neighborhood. So it made everything and everybody every day started in a much more pleasant place than, you know, half the band sitting around waiting for the other half of the band to show up, you know, after sitting in traffic for 2 hours. So I just remembered it being like kind of effortless, really. It was didn't take very long to make. The songs just sort of showed up. It was extremely just a wonderful experience from beginning to end. And I just remember how, you know, the guys, like they could run home for lunch and see their kids and then come back to the studio, like stuff you really couldn't do. And you had to commute from Hollywood. So it was pretty great.
Yeah, and it was like an Americana album, but also had some rocking song. Like, Do the Murray was more rocking, right?
Yeah, I think we can we win something for that as well.
Look it up for you really fast. Tin Can Trust was nominated for Americana album, and Do the Murray was nominated for rock instrumental, but went home empty-handed, sadly. But but you did more recently. Let's end here. More recently, you did win Best Americana Album for Native Sons at what was this? Like just 2022, just a couple years ago.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing, really. So the quick story in that was we signed with a new record label, and we inevitably when we're doing this, like, you know, for us to make a record, it generally means we cut out like 2 months or so of our touring schedule to make the record, for the writers to write, and then we get in the studio and start making it. And so we signed a record deal, and but we had already sort of set our touring plans for, I guess this would be right around 2020, and then the pandemic hits, and obviously everybody's touring plans are out the window, and everybody's locked down, and we're sort of like, well, like everybody else, we're sort of high and dry and like, all right, what are we going to do? Will there even be a touring business? Are we all going to die? Like, you know, we're all, everybody's in the same place, more or less.
Right.
So the concept of that record became, well, why don't we see what we could do if we just do it in bits and pieces? So that's more or less where the notion of a love letter to LA came from. So we thought, why not, you know, make this as fun and pleasant as possible for ourselves and stuff we could, and, you know, we don't have to sit down and write and record 11, 12, 13 songs at once. Let's just do what we can while we can. So as the coronavirus, you know, the restrictions lifted, travel was a little easier. We made this plan of getting together like 2 or 3 days a month. And we found this yet another nice studio, a really nice studio in East LA. So it was local and it was big enough that we could, appropriately distanced. So like we had, you know, we were observing every protocol. We would have somebody come in and test us every day. So we were, you know, trying to make a record under COVID protocols with our masks on and our, you know, 6 feet away and, you know, washing our hands every 30 seconds and all that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, but lo and behold, it kind of worked. It kept us sane. We're actually able to, like, you know, have fun with it and, you know, record stuff that we liked and, in some cases, bring our friends in and just sort of, like I said, like help us stay sane as the whole crazy COVID year was unfolding. And I think the contract for the label, for the record label was like, I think it was 12 songs, and we weren't even like keeping count. We were just doing it just because it was fun and we were enjoying the process. And I remember like we'd started, I think February 2021, and we got to September, and I thought, well, let's see where we're at. Cause I kind of thought, okay, well, probably have 10 or 11 songs by now. We'd actually recorded like 15 songs without even thinking about it. So we were done. I mean, we were overdone and ready to go. And that was, you know, it was like kind of, I just remember being like, how the heck do we get this many songs without even trying? But it was literally that. It was just that we'd done it over such a long period of time, and we're just sort of like, literally just sort of trying to stay alive and stay sane through all of that craziness. And lo and behold, we make a record, it comes out, we win a Grammy. It was all kind of amazing.
Not only do you win, I think you beat Jackson Browne that year. So.
Yeah, I know. We beat a lot of our friends and, you know, I'm close. I mean, I know Alison Russell. I mean, I did, you know, if anybody was watching those Grammys, like the Grammys were supposed to happen in LA, but because of COVID and everything else, they moved it to Las Vegas, and it was in April or something like that. So the guys didn't even go, like they didn't think we were going to win. So I was the only guy in the band that actually went for the ceremony was me. Wow. And I thought, well, there's no way we're going to beat, you know, it was Jackson Browne. I think Taj Mahal, if I'm not mistaken, Alison Russell, who else?
Yola.
I mean, there were a lot of heavy hitters in the category. Well, you know, it's a 3 days in Vegas. Who's going to complain? It's great. And lo and behold, we win. So yeah, it's always fun. It's never not a good day when you win a Grammy.
Yeah, you're right. Thanks for jogging the memory. That was one of those weird COVID different locations. I think that was the John Batiste year when he won all that stuff. But or maybe it was Silk Sonic, both of them. Anyway, so yeah, well, congrats. I guess sort of like final seconds. I know, you've done a great job taking us through the history. Well, at least, you know, the rock skipping across the Grammy pond, at least. There's so much in between, everybody go back and look back at. But I just sort of in final seconds, you know, I guess you were what, nominated for, you know, on the short list for the Rock Hall back in like 2015. What do we got to do to get you all in there? I mean, we just laid out the case, I think, in this interview of all the stuff, I know most people don't even say we don't even care about that. It's all about the music, but
I swear to God, these awards are lovely. The parties are always fun. It's great to see all your friends or, you know, meet new friends, but it's nothing we think about. We literally spend 0 seconds ever thinking about, you know, that. We know we're just happy to have a career. We get to go to places like, you know, Charlestown, West Virginia, and, you know, get to do this for a living and, you know, take care of our family. So it's literally all we could ever ask for, to have that. You know, if we win an award, great. If we get in the Hall of Fame, great. But it's nothing that we think about or worry about or, you know, even politic about. Like, if it happens, it happens. If it, you know, we're perfectly fine. If it never happens, it's really not that big a deal.
Exactly. So awards aside, what do you want the legacy of Los Lobos to be? You know, and years from now, when, you know, when we're all, when you finally hang it up, when you break your last speaker, what do you want the legacy of the group to be?
Well, you know, I think if you ask me like what I'm proudest of, there's not a lot of bands. I mean, how many bands get to 50 years, period? So there's us, the Allman Brothers, and the Rolling Stones, and who else? I don't know. I mean, it's not that many. You know, to still make valuable, you know, we try really hard to not look back. We try really hard. And, you know, you've never heard of La Bamba 2. Like, we try to keep moving forward, and we literally, you know, work as hard as we can to maintain the same attitude that we had when we started, just to make the best possible music and play the best shows we possibly can. And I think that in and of itself is, I mean, that's, I think, a pretty cool legacy. Cause, you know, I mean, let's face it, like, a lot of bands that have been around as long as we have, a lot of times, you know, they stop caring about what the records sound like, cause they really don't matter anymore. And anybody who comes to see them just wants to hear the hits anyway. So they stop putting they stopped caring about it, and we never did. Like, we still care a lot. We still want the records to be as good as, you know, the next one to be as good as every other one prior. So I think that's what I'm proudest of, that they, you know, we've managed to maintain a pretty high standard.
That's perfect place to leave it. Hey, congrats on 50 years. Here's to another 50. Los Lobos coming to the Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races in West Virginia, just outside of the D.C. area. It'll be Friday, April 12th. So get your tickets now, everybody. You've been great. This was so much fun. Thanks for sticking around so long.
Thanks. My pleasure. Enjoy that.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. Our theme music is Scott Buckley's Clarion. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. We'll see you next time.